In the annual tradition of a winter solstice ghost story, Wayward Studio offers this. The Ghost and the Bone Setter by Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, 1838. In looking over the papers of my late valued and respected friend Francis Purcell, who for nearly 50 years discharged the arduous duties of a parish priest in the south of Ireland, I met with the following document. It is one of many such, for he was a curious and industrious collector of old local traditions, a commodity in which the quarter where he resided mightily abounded. The collection and arrangement of such legends was, as long as I can remember him, his hobby. But I had never learned that his love of the marvelous and whimsical had carried him so far as to prompt him to commit the results of his inquiries to writing, until, in the character of residuary legatee, his will put me in possession of all his manuscript papers. To such as may think the composing of such productions as these inconsistent with the character and habits of a country priest, it is necessary to observe that there did exist a race of priests, those of the old school, a race now nearly extinct, whose habits were from many causes more refined, and whose tastes more literary, than are those of the alumni of Maynooth. It is perhaps necessary to add that the superstition illustrated by the following story, namely, that the corpse last buried is obliged, during his juniority of interment, to supply his brother tenants of the churchyard in which he lies with fresh water to allay the burning thirst of purgatory, is prevalent throughout the south of Ireland. The writer can vouch for a case in which a respectable and wealthy farmer, on the borders of Tipperary, in tenderness to the corns of his departed helpmate, enclosed in her coffin two pair of brogues, a light and a heavy, the one for dry, the other for sloppy weather. Seeking thus to mitigate the fatigues of her inevitable perambulations in procuring water and administering it to the thirsty souls of purgatory, fierce and desperate conflicts have ensued in the case of two funeral parties approaching the same churchyard together, each endeavoring to secure to his own dead priority of sepulture and a consequent immunity from the tax levied upon the pedestrian powers of the last comer. An instance not long since occurred in which one of two such parties, through fear of losing to their deceased friend this inestimable advantage, made their way to the churchyard by a short cut, and in violation of one of the strongest prejudices, actually threw the coffin over the wall, lest time should be lost in making their entrance through the gate. Innumerable instances of the same kind might be quoted, all tending to show how strongly, among the peasantry of the South, this superstition is entertained. However, I shall not detain the reader further by any prefatory remarks, but shall proceed to lay before him the following. Extract from the miscellaneous papers of the late Reverend Francis Purcell of Drumcolough. I tell the following particulars, as nearly as I can recollect them, in the words of the narrator. It may be necessary to observe that he was what is termed a well-spoken man, having for a considerable time instructed the ingenious youth of his native parish in such of the liberal arts and sciences as he found it convenient to profess, or a circumstance which may account for the occurrence of several big words in the course of his narrative, more distinguished for euphonious effect than for correctness of application. I proceed then, without further preface, to lay before you the wonderful adventures of Terry Neal.
Why, then, 'tis a queer story, and as true as you're sitting there, and I'd make bold to say there isn't a boy in the seven parishes could tell it better nor quicker than myself, for 'twas my father himself it happened to, and many the time I heard it out of his own mouth. And I can say, and I'm proud of that same, my father's word was incredible as any squire's oath in the country. And so signs that if a poor man got into any unlucky trouble, he was the boy I'd go into the court and prove. But that doesn't signify. He was as honest and as sober a man, barring he was a little too partial to the glass, as you'd find in a day's walk. And there wasn't the likes of him in the country round for nate labouring and bond digging. and he was mighty handy entirely for carpenter's work and mending old spud for these and the likes of that. And so he took up with bone-setting, as was most natural, for none of them could come up to him in mending the leg of a stool or a table. And sure, there never was a bone-setter got so much custom. Man and child, young and old, there never was such breaking and mending of bones known in the memory of man. Well, Terry Neal, for that was my father's name, began to feel his heart growing light and his purse heavy, and he took a bit of a farm in Squire Fallon's ground, just under the old castle, and a pleasant little spot it was. And day and morning, poor Claith is not able to put a foot to the ground. With broken arms and broken legs, it'd be coming rambling in from all quarters to have their bones spliced up. Well, Your Honor, all this was as well could be. But it was customary when Sir Phelim had go out anywhere out of the country for some of the tenants to sit up to watch in the old castle, just for a kind of compliment to the old family. And a mighty unpleasant compliment it was for the tenants, for there wasn't a man of them but knew there was something queer about that old castle. The neighbors had it that the squire's old grandfather, as good a gentleman, God be with him, as I hear it has ever stood in shoe leather, used to keep walking about in the middle of the night, ever since he bursted a blood vessel pulling out a cork under the bottle, as you or I might be doing, and will too, please God, but that doesn't signify. So, as I was saying, the old squire used to come down out of the frame where his picture was hung up and to break the bottles and glasses. God be merciful to us all, and to link all he could come at. And small blame to him for that same. And then if any of the family had be coming in, he'd be up there again in his place, looking as quite as innocent as if he didn't know anything about it. Mischievous old chap. Well, Your Honor, as I was saying, one time, the family up at the castle was staying in Dublin for a week or two, and so, as usual, some of the tenants had to sit up in the castle. The third night, it come to my father's turn. "Oh, Turnuns," said he unto himself, "on must I sit up night, and that old vagabond of a spirit, glory be to God," says he, "serenading through the house and doing all sorts of mischief." However, there was no getting left, and so he put a bold face on it, and he went up at nightfall with a bottle of poteen and another of holy water. It was raining smart enough, and the evening was darksome and gloomy when my father got in, and the holy water he sprinkled on himself, and it wasn't long till he had to swallow a cup of the poteen to keep the cold out of his heart. It was the old steward, Lawrence Connor, that opened the door, and he and my father were always very great. So when he seen who it was, and my father told him how it was, his turn to watch in the castle, he offered to sit up along with him. And you may be sure my father wasn't sorry for that same. So says Larry, "Well, I've got a bit of the fire in the parlor," says he. "And why not in the hall?" says my father, for he knew that the squire's picture was hung in the parlor. "No fire can be lit in the hall," says Lawrence, "for there's an old jackdaw's nest in the chimney." "Oh, thin," says my father, "let us stop in the kitchen, for it's a very improper for the likes of me to be sitting in the parlor," says he. "Ah, Terry, that can't be," says Lawrence. "If we keep up the old custom at all, we may as well keep it up properly," says he. "Devil sweep the old custom," says my father to himself. "Do you mind?" For he didn't like to let Lawrence see that he was more feared himself. "Oh, very well," says he. "I'm agreeable, Lawrence," says he. And so down they both went to the kitchen, until the fire had been lit under the parlor, and that same wasn't long doing. Well, Your Honor, they soon went up again, and sat down mighty comfortable by the parlor fire, and they begin to talk, and to smoke, and to drink a small taste of the poaching, and moreover, they had a good rousing fire of bogwood and turf to warm their shins over. Well, sir, as I was saying, they keep conversing and smoking together most agreeable until Lawrence began to get sleepy, as was but natural for him, for he was an old servant man and was used to get a great deal of sleep. "Sure, it's impossible," says my father. "It's getting sleepy you are." "Ah, devil a taste," says Larry. "I'm only shutting my eyes," says he, "to keep out the perfume of the tobacco smoke that's making them wild. So don't you mind other people's business," says he, stiff enough, for he had a mighty high stomach of his own, rest his soul. "And go on," says he, "with your story. I'm for listening," says he, shutting down his eyes. Well, my father, seeing spaking was no use, and he went on with the story. By the same token, it was the story of Jim Sullivan and his old goat he was telling, and a pleasant story it is, and there was no such diversion in it, for it was enough to waken a dormouse, let alone to prevent a Christian going to sleep. But, fah, the way my father told it, I believe there never was the likes heard since nor before, for he bawled out every word of it, as if the life was fairly leaving him, trying to keep old Larry awake. But, fah, it was no use, for the hoarseness came on him, and before he can come to the end of the story, Larry O'Connor began to snore like a bagpipes. "Oh, Blernaglis," says my father, "isn't this a hard case? That old villain letting on to be my friend, and to go to sleep this way, and us both in the very room with a spirit," says he. "The class of Christ about us, you see," and with that he was going to shake Lawrence to waken him. But he just remembered if he roused him that he'd surely go off to his bed and leave him completely alone, and that'd be far worse. "Oh, then," says my father, "I'll not disturb the poor boy. It'd be neither friendly nor a good night," said he, "to torment him while he's asleep," says he. "Only I wish I was the same way myself," says he. And with that, he began to walk up and down and saying his prayers until he worked himself into a sweat, saving your presence. But it was all no good, so he drunk about a pint of spirits to compose his mind. "Oh," says he, "I wish to the Lord I was as easy in my mind as Larry there. Maybe," says he, "if I tried to go, I could go to sleep." And with that, he pulled a big armchair close beside Lawrence and settled himself in it as well as he could. There was one queer thing I forgot to tell you. He couldn't help, in spite of himself, looking now and then at the picture, and he immediately observed that the eyes of it was following him about and staring at him and winking at him wherever he went. "Oh," says he, when he's seen that, "it's a poor chance I have," says he. "And bad luck was with me the day I came into this unfortunate place," says he. "But anyway, there's no use in me being fleckened now," says he, "for if I am to die, I might as well perspire undaunted," says he. Well, Your Honor, he tried to keep himself quiet and easy, and he thought two or three times he might have went to sleep, but for the way the storm was groaning and creaking through the great heavy branches outside and whistling through the old chimneys of the castle well, after one great roaring blast of the wind, you'd think the walls of the castle was just going to fall, quiet and clean, with the shaking of it. All of a sudden, the storm stopped, as silent and as quiet as if it was a July evening. Well, Your Honor, it wasn't stopped blowing for 3 minutes before he thought he heard a sort of a noise over the chimney piece. And with that, my father just opened his eyes, the smallest taste in life. And sure enough, he seen the old squire getting out of the picture, for all the world as if he was throwing off his riding coat, until he stepped out clean and complete out of the chimney piece and thrown himself down on the floor. Well, this living old chap, and my father thought it was the dirtiest turn of all. Before he began to do anything out of the way, he stopped for a while to listen were they both asleep. And as soon as he thought all was quite well, he put out his hand and took hold of the whiskey bottle and drank the last pint of it. Well, Your Honor, when he took his turn out of it, he settled it back mighty cute entirely in the very same spot it was in before. And he began to walk up and down the room, looking as sober and as solid as if he'd never done the likes at all. And whenever he went past my father, he thought he felt a great scent of brimstone. And it was that that frightened him entirely, for he knew it was brimstone that was burned in hell, saving your presence. At any rate, he often heard it from Father Murphy, and if he had a right to know what belonged to it, he's dead sense, God rest him. Well, Your Honor, my father was easy enough until the spirit came past him, so close. God be merciful to us all, that the smell of the sulfur took the breath clean out of him. And with that, he took such a fit of coughing that it all almost shook him out of his chair he was sitting in. "Oh," says the squire, stopping short about 2 steps and turning round facing my father. "There's the eel that's in it. How's all with you, Terry Neal?" "At your honor's service," says my father, as well as the fright had led him, for he was more dead than alive. "And as proud I am to see your honor tonight," says he. "Terence," said the squire, "you're a respectable man," and it was true for him, "an industrious, sober man, and an example of inebriety to the whole parish," says he. "Oh, thank you, honor," says my father, getting courage. "You were always a civil-spoken gentleman, God rest your honor." Rest my honor, says the spirit, fairly get red in the face with the madness. Rest my honor, says he. Why, you ignorant spalpeen, says he. You mean, niggardly ignoramish, says he. Where did you have your manners, says he. If I am dead, it's no fault of mine, says he. And it's not to be thrown in my teeth at every hand's turn by the likes of you, says he, stamping his foot on the floor that he'd think the boards would be smashed under him. Oh, says my father, I'm only a foolish, ignorant, poor man, says he. You're nothing else, says the squire. But anyway, says he, it's not to be listening to your gossip, not conversing with the likes of you that I came up. Down, I mean, says he. And as little as the mistake was, my father took notice of it. Listen to me now, Terence Neal, says he. I was always a good master to Patrick Neal, your grandfather, says he. Oh, 'tis true, for your honor, says my father. And moreover, I think I was always a sober, regular gentleman, says the squire. That's your name, sure enough, says my father, though it was a big lie for him, but he could not help it. Well, says the spirit, although I was as sober as most men, at last as most gentlemen, says he, and though I was a different pad, a most extemporary Christian, and most charitable and inhuman to the poor, says he, for all that, I'm not as easy where I am now as I had a right to expect, says he. Oh, more's the pity, says my father. Maybe your honor had wished to have a word with Father Murphy. Hold your tongue, you miserable blackguard, said the squire. It's not of my soul I'm thinking, and I wonder you'd have the impertinence to talk to a gentleman concerning his soul. And when I want that fixed, says he, slapping his thigh, I'll go to him that knows what belongs to the likes. It's not my soul, says he, sitting down opposite my father. Not my soul that's annoyed me most. I'm uneasy on my right leg, says he, that I broke at Clanvilla cover the day I killed Black Barney. Now, my father found out after it was a favorite horse that fell under him after leaping the big fence that runs along by the glen. Oh, I hope, says my father, your honor's not uneasy about the killing of him. Hold your tongue, you fool, says the squire, and I'll tell you what I'm uneasy at my leg, says he, in the place where I spend most of my time, except a little leisure I have for looking about me here, says he. I have to walk a great deal more than I was ever used to, says he, and by far more than is good for me either, says he. For I must tell you, says he, the people where I am is uncommonly fond of cold water, for there is nothing better to be had, and, moreover, the weather is hotter than is altogether pleasant, says he. And I'm appointed, says he, to assist in carrying the water, and gets a mighty poor share of it to myself, says he. And a mighty troublesome wearing job it is, I can tell you, for they are all of them surprisingly dry, and drinks it as fast as my legs can carry it, says he. But what kills me entirely, says he, is the weakness in my leg, and I want you to give it a pull or two to bring it to shape, says he. And that's the long and short of it, says he. Oh, please, your honor, says my father, for he didn't like to handle the spirit at all. I wouldn't have the impertinence to do the likes to your honor. It's only to poor creatures like myself I do it to, says he. None of your blarney, says the squire. Here's my leg, says he, cocking it up to him. Pull it for your bare life, says he. And if you don't, by the immortal powers, I'll not leave a bone in your carcass, I'll not powder, says he. When my father heard that, he'd seen there was no use in pretending, so he took hold of the leg, and he kept pulling and pulling till the sweat, God bless us, began to pour down his face. Pull, your devil, said the squire. At your service, your honor, says my father. Pull harder, said the squire. Oh, my father, he pulled like the devil. I'll take a little sup, said the squire, reaching over his hand to the bottle. To keep up my courage, says he, letting on to be very weak in himself entirely. But as astute as he was, he was out here, for he took the wrong one. Here's to your good health, Terence, says he, and now pull like the very devil. And with that, he lifted the bottle of holy water. But it was hardly to his mouth when he let a screech out. You'd think that the room had fairly split with it, and made one chuck that sent the leg clean off his body in my father's hands. down went the squire over the table, and bang went my father halfway across the room on his back upon the floor. When he came to himself, the cheerful morning sun was shining through the windy shutters, and he was lying flat on his back with a leg of one of the great old chairs pulled clean out of the socket and tight in his hand, pinting up to the ceiling as old Larry, fast asleep and snoring as loud as ever. My father went that morning to Father Murphy, and from that day to the day of his death, he never neglected confession nor mass, and what he told was better believed than he spake of, but it seldom. And as for the squire, that is, of the spirit, whether it was that he did not like his liquor, or by reason of the loss of his leg, he was never known to walk again.
The Waywards Podcast is a production of Waywards Studio. Find us at waywardsstudio.com.